Hello and welcome or welcome back to Sex, Scandal, and Shenanigans podcast. My name is Adrian and I'll be your host. In this show, I discuss history's most notorious mistresses and lovers. Today's episode will be featuring one of the youngest Roman emperors, Elagabalus. The reign of Elagabalus is known for many controversies, namely religious and for sexual deviancy. Please note that today's episode will be discussing LGBTQIA+ issues, sexuality, and other potentially triggering topics. Listener discretion is advised. Just as a side note, I will be addressing Elagabalus either by their name or using the they/their pronoun. I'm not sure if they consider themselves transgender or not, so therefore they're going to be referred to by their name and or they/their. Before going into Elagabalus's life, we need to mention the many people who were influential in this emperor's life. All right, here we go. Elagabalus, Sextus Varius Marcellus, Julia Somaeus Bassania, Caracalla, Marcus Aurelius Antoninus, Julia Mesa, Severus Alexander, Lucius Septimius Severus, Marcus Opelius Macrinus, and a bunch of others. Also, because the Severan dynasty came after Hadrian and Marcus Aurelius, we need to do a quick recap of the end of the Nervan line to the Severan dynasty. From this point on, I will refer to our main character, or featured person, as the name most associated with them, Elagabalus. Prior to Elagabalus' ascension in 218, Rome was then led by the Praetorian prefect, Macrinus. To gain power, Julia Mesa, the grandmother of Elagabalus, crafted the story that Elagabalus was the illegitimate son of Julius Somaeus and the Roman Emperor Caracalla. The story goes that Julius Somaeus and Caracalla had relations and outpopped Elagabalus. By doing this, Julius Somaeus and Julia Mesa were then able to garner support from the military, who then deserted Macrinus. Let's do a little bit of backup and family history from Elagabalus' line. Here's his familial backstory. His family was from the Syrian area of the Roman Empire, also Emesa. His father was Sextus Varius Marcellus, came from the equestrian class, but then was able to elevate to the senatorial class. His mother, Julia Somaeus, was a cousin of Caracalla. His grandmother was Julia Mesa, widow of Roman consul Julius Avidius Alexianus, whose sister was the Dowager Empress Julia Domna, who was the wife of Septimius Severus. Through Julia Mesa and her connection, when Elagabalus moved to Rome, they also took their preference for their god over what or who was traditionally prayed to. This became a big controversy. Speaking of religious controversies, here's a couple of issues. One, they made Elagabalus the primary god over Jupiter. This god was then added to the pantheon of the Roman gods and became known as Sol, or also Sol Invictus, the unconquered sun. Elagabalus tried to make a union between Elagabalus, the god, not the emperor, and Astarte, akin to Ishtar, Minerva, Athena, and Urania, muse of astrology. Elagabalus tried to have them married, but then divorced, then married, then divorced, and then married, and it was just a hot mess. Anyway, number two, Elagabalus, the emperor, ordered that Jews, Samaritans, and Christians were ordered or forced to transfer their religious practices to the Elagabalus temple because they might need to include the mysteries of every form of worship. And that is per the Augustan history. Again, that one's also a biased source material against Elagabalus. After their execution, the cult of Elagabalus, the god, ended and the cult went back to Emesa, you know, their hometown. Wife of Septimius Severus, it was this way by solidifying their connection to the imperial family. Also, Julia Mesa and Julius Somaeus also created the story that Elagabalus was the illegitimate son of former Emperor Caracalla. It's not true, but the propaganda worked. Sextus Varius Marcellus and Julius Somaeus were probably married around 200 AD, and it is assumed that their son, Sextus Varius Avidus Bassianus, also known as Elagabalus, was born around 204 AD in the Syrian of Emesa, which is now current-day Homs in Syria. Also, there are some contemporary sources that state he was born in Rome. The importance of his birthplace is significant because it plays a major role in terms of religion. Here's his religious background, or at least the family's religious background. Because the family came from the Syrian area of the Roman Empire, cultural and religious traditions and processes were different from mainland Rome. Like the Pontifex Maximus for the Vestal Virgins, this will become extremely important later, Elagabalus and his family had hereditary rights and right to the god Elagabal, who was the sun god. If, by what the sources have determined as their birth year, in 218, Elagabalus was only 14 when they ascended the throne. But I do need to talk about how they got to the throne. So let's discuss. After the murder of Caracalla in 217 AD, Praetorian prefect Macrinus, Marcus Opilius Macrinus, took over as the de facto emperor of Rome. He told Julia Maesa, Elagabalus's grandmother, to move back to Emesa with her family. The thought process of Macrinus was that he wanted to avoid or prevent any upheavals from the Roman army, who were supportive of Caracalla. Macrinus also allowed Julia Maesa to have access to her wealth and estates after ousting her after her nephew's murder. This became a major mistake. Fortunately for Julia Maesa, being in Emesa was close to a military post. She used this to her advantage. The military and legions were loyal to the Severn family, and because of this, Julia Maesa was able to continue and garner military support to overthrow Macrinus. In 218 AD, the time had arrived for Julia Maesa to use her wealth and influence to overthrow and create a successful coup on Macrinus. To bolster her family's claim of legitimacy, I stated earlier that the story of Caracalla fathering Elagabalus was used, and it worked. Also, apparently, Elagabalus had resembled Caracalla enough to not have the story refuted. On the 16th of May, 218 AD, her grandson was proclaimed emperor with the support of the Roman military. Huh, I guess you can buy anything, including loyalty and empires. Unlike Augustus, who, being only a few years older as Julius Caesar's heir, Elagabalus may have been a governmental figurehead as the emperor, but not really having or holding any political power. That came from mommy Julia Maesa and grandma Julia Maesa. When Elagabalus was made the Roman Empire, they took the name Imperator Caesar Marcus Aurelius Antoninus Augustus, but was still known as Elagabalus. As stated previously, at 14 years old, he was, like Nero before him, guided by his mother and grandmother in terms of leading the empire, but teenagers are gonna teenage. What's important to teens? Fashion, belonging, at least socially, and even being rebellious when unnecessary. Elagabalus did these things unlike the majority of teens today. Elagabalus had access to what most adults don't, the Roman treasury, a never-ending bag of gold. You know what else he had access to? An elite military guard, and all the six silks, and all the attention a young teenager could ask for. As I stated earlier, I kind of went over his name, but just to give you another quick little insight, the family had hereditary rights as the leading priestly family to the god Elagabal, a Roman Arabic sun god. That's it. It's that simple. Moving on to Cassius Dio's comments about Elagabalus and to whom they were compared. Cassius Dio compared Elagabalus to the last mythical Assyrian king, Sardanapalus. Apparently, Sardanapalus was known to dress and emulate feminine clothing, as well as partaking in more feminine domestic tasks like sewing and weaving. This is coming from his Epitome of a Book, Book 80. Remember, Cassius Dio is similar to our old friend Tacitus when speaking on the trustworthiness of his works. He was not a fan at all of Elagabalus and wrote about them quite mockingly and without objectivity. Cassius Dio also lived during and after Elagabalus's reign, so take it with a mountain of salt. Shall we dive into what Cassius Dio has to say about Elagabalus? Let's go. Just a brief reminder, Cassius Dio was not a fanboy of Elagabalus. Cassio, in Epitome of Book 80, starts thusly describing Elagabalus. Now, Avidus, otherwise known as the false Antoninus, or the Assyrian, or Sardanapalus, or even Tiberinus, the last appellation he received after he had been slain and his body had been thrown into the Tiber. So, from this introduction, we can presume that Cassius Dio gave him describing names that were certainly not praiseworthy. He continues to describe more of Elagabalus' shenanigans. About himself, he made many promises, not only to the soldiers, but also to the Senate and the people, asserting that he would always, and in all things, emulate Augustus. Isn't it fun when politicians lie to us? I mean, straight off the bat, Cassius Dio doesn't even call Elagabalus Avidus or their preferred name of Elagabalus, but the false Antoninus. Yikes. Well, the false Antoninus marries Julia Cornelia Paula so that they could produce a child. Cassius Dio then literally shouts, "He who could not even be a man." That's from chapter 9. According to Dio, the Senate and the people of the equestrian classes questioned the marriage of Cornelia Paula and Elagabalus. Julia Cornelia Paulus' family history includes her father, Julius Paulus, who was a jurist and praetorian prefect under the Severan dynasty. Julia Cornelia Paulus' mother was from the Cornelius line, of which was an old and noble family. By 219, Elagabalus' grandmother, grandmother Julia Maesa, arranged the wedding between the two young ones. Apparently, it was one hell of a party. Here's one of the descriptions of the wedding. The ceremony, hosted by Julia Somaias and grandma Julia Maesa, was paid per deo, 600 sesterces apiece, 400 sesterces for the soldiers. Gladiators were fighting. There were 51 tigers and an elephant, along with other animals that were hunted and killed. This ceremony certainly outshone the parties that Nero threw during his reign. After about a year of marriage, Elagabalus decided to call it quits with Julia Cornelia, because apparently she had some type of blemish on her body. Again, according to our salty friend Cassius Dio. So after his divorce from Julia Cornelia, Elagabalus then started shacking up with a woman named Aquila Severa. Sounds romantic, right? Being favored by the emperor? Yeah, no, not at all. Spoiler alert, Aquila Severa was a Vestal Virgin. Vestal Virgins were important to Roman society. So what did the Vestal Virgins do? Well, according to Britannica, Vestal Virgins in the Roman religion were six priestesses representing the daughters of the royal house who tended the state cult of Vesta, the goddess of the hearth. Continue on from Britannica, chosen between the ages of 6 and 10 by the Pontifex Maximus, the high priest or the chief priest, Vestal Virgins served for 30 years, during which time they had to remain virgins. Afterward, they could marry, but apparently a few did. Those chosen as Vestal Virgins had to be required age, be freeborn, and a freeborn and respectable parent, though later the daughters of freedmen were eligible. Both have parents alive, be free from physical and mental defects. They lived in the house of the Vestal Virgins on the Roman Forum near the Temple of Vesta. Their duties included tending to the perpetual fire in the Temple of Vesta, keeping their vow of chastity, fetching water from the sacred spring, preparing ritual food, caring for objects in the inner temple's inner sanctuary, and officiating at the Vestalia from June 5th to the 7th through the 15th. Also, failure to attend their duties was punished by a beating, violation of the vow of chastity, by burial alive. The blood of a Vestal Virgin could not be spilled. That's nice. But the Vestal Virgins also enjoyed many honors and privileges not open to married or single women of equivalent social status, including emancipation from their father's rule and the ability to handle their own property. Again, that's from Britannica. So, Elagabalus, being the teenage shit that he is, decided to divorce his first wife for a Vestal Virgin, Aquileia Severa. Yeah, this was frowned upon by Roman society. Like, even his grandmother, Julia Maeso, was not happy with this decision. Anyone who slept with the Vestal Virgin that didn't complete their Vestal Virgin commitment was in effect assaulting the embodiment of Rome itself and the gods and could be killed with impunity. Elagabalus did this anyway. Let's see. Aquila Severa was impiously defiled, according to Cassius Dio. Elagabalus is quoted as saying why he wanted to be with Aquileia Severa. I did it in order that godlike children might spring from me, the high priest of Elagabalus, and from her, the high priestess. I understand what he's saying. He wants to have the high priestess of Vesta, you know, marry and then consummate their marriage to beget a child that was favored upon the gods. But remember, he was like 14 or 15 when he said this, and it's very short-sighted and not plausible because of Roman customs. Somehow, Elagabalus was able to not get killed after committing such a religious crime. In any case, their relationship did not last long. She was Elagabalus's consort from 220 to 221 and from 221 to 222 AD. Keep in mind, Roman law dictated some of the rules for Vestal Virgins. They cannot marry until after being part of the cult and priestesses or priestess for 30 years. Some girls started around 6 or 7 years old, and the 30-year commitment includes 3 decades-long duties of becoming students, teachers, and servants and or servitude. Usually, Vestals ended their commitments by the time of being in their 30s or 40s, depending on when their service began. The Pontifex Maximus, the head priest, may arrange marriages for the eligible retired Vestals. Some did marry, but many did not have many happy marriages and wanted to go back to serving Vesta. Let's get back on track to the relationship for Aquileia Severa and Elagabalus's relationship. It was controversial for many reasons. One, Vestal Virgins could not marry after their terms of service. Remember, 30-year commitment. Two, he wanted to marry someone with whom they could get a divine child. Though Elagabalus was more of a follower of Elagabal, the Roman Syrian sun god. I should also mention here that Elagabalus also went by the name Heliogabalus in reference to Helios, the sun god, and joined Abalus part of his name. But for continuity purposes, continue calling them Elagabalus. Well, in any case, Grandma, Julia Mesa, commuted the marriage between Elagabalus and Aquila Severa. Julia Mesa then decided to have Elagabalus marry Roman noblewoman Ania Faustina and became Elagabalus's third empress. Eesh. Ania Faustina came from the imperial family. Her parents were Tiberius Claudius Severus Proculus and Ania Faustina. Her father's parents were senators. They were Greek, but they were also from Anatolia in the area of modern Turkey. Gnaeus Claudius Severus and his second wife, Ania Galeria Aurelia Faustina, who was the daughter of Marcus Aurelius, the former emperor, and one of his heirs of Hadrian. Anyway, they married in 221, which was considered a more acceptable marriage for Elagabalus. This was not a happy marriage. Ania Faustina was married prior to her marriage to Elagabalus. She was previously married to Pomponius Bassus. The couple had two children, Pomponio Ummidia, she was born in about 219, and their son Pompeius Bassus, born in 220. So, in 221, an eventful year for Ania Faustina. Her husband, Pomponius, lived up to his name as he was executed for committing subversion and treason. I say living up to his name because I see his name and I think of a pompous asshole. In 218, just a quick backup here, Ania Faustina's parents died and she inherited their estates. After the execution of her first husband, Julia Mesa decided for Elagabalus that they would benefit from aligning with the Nerva Antonine family, and he was also her great-grandfather. Additionally, Julia Mesa wanted to erase the taint of Elagabalus' decision to marry a Vestal virgin. Ugh, wife number two. This relationship lasted for less than a year. Her tenure was only in 221 AD. By 221, again later that year, Elagabalus divorced Ania Faustina and then had Aquila Severa move back in to live with him, nullifying and deciding that their initial divorce was not valid. Elagabalus and Aquila Severa's relationship ended when Elagabalus was assassinated in March of 222. It is believed by historians and scholars that she remained with Elagabalus until his end, but it hasn't been confirmed. According to Carpe Diem Tours, written by Alexander Meddings, states that his sex life makes that of a bunga bunga maestro, Signore Berlusconi, seem quite mild and tame. Apparently, Elagabalus truly lived the life of a horny and hedonistic emperor. It has been attributed to Elagabalus that he never slept with the same woman more than once, though we know that's not true regarding Aquila Severa, though no children came from their union. In addition to the scores of women Elagabalus slept with, men and charioteers were also another favorite pastime of the young emperor. Also, as Meddings puts it, describing Elagabalus, a Roman emperor sleeping with a charioteer would have been more scandalous than King Charles of England bedding Caitlyn Jenner and establishing her as a consort in Buckingham Palace. The last two most scandalous relationship that Elagabalus had partaken in was with the charioteer Heracles, H-I-E-R-O-C-L-E-S. He too is Greek. And Aurelius Zoticus. I'll get into it in a bit. What is known about Heracles is limited. We do know that he was probably born in the late 100s, late 2nd century. This is probably means that he was older than Elagabalus. Heracles was from Caria, Asia Minor, or modern-day Western Turkey. He became enslaved and through his enslavement became a charioteer to Elagabalus. Prior to his imperial service, Heracles was also a lover and former student of another charioteer, Gordius. Apparently, Heracles was blonde and Elagabalus became entranced by the man. Heracles then married Elagabalus, probably in 221 or 222 AD. To maintain his status as Elagabalus' favorite, Heracles kicked out Aurelius Zoticus, an athlete from Smyrna, Greece. Aurelius was a eunuch, chamberlain in the imperial household, but still he became a favorite of Elagabalus. To compound even more salacious stories about Elagabalus, Cassius Dial, our very salty friend, continues to write that Elagabalus visited many brothels, lived licentiously, and would travel to many taverns at night wearing a disguise. These disguises include wearing a wig and then using that disguise to ply the trade of sex workers, particularly hinting at working as a female sex worker. Dio then continues to say that he frequented notorious brothels, kicking out the prostitutes, and then plying their trade himself. Even more so, Dio wrote that he behaved all alike who had said such relations with him, but he had, besides, one favorite husband whom he wished to appoint Caesar for that very reason. This refers to his relationship with Heracles, the charioteer. Elagabalus was also to have said about Heracles, "I am delighted to be the mistress, the wife, the queen of Heracles." This quote reminds me of Nero's relationship with Sporus, and that Nero and Elagabalus were the passive partners in the relationship. Those were the notorious relationships of Elagabalus. But we're not done yet. We need to discuss the extravagance of this reign. Bear in mind, Elagabalus was only emperor for 4 years. Only 4 years. Let's continue. Elagabalus loved, and I mean loved, to party. Per Metting, Elagabalus loved to throw rose petal orgies. So many petals were used that revelers were sometimes smothered and unable to crawl out of the piles. Elagabalus also gave political offices and positions to hung men. Yes, not young hung men, just hung men. Furthermore, these hung men were also made available for more than political counsel, if you catch my drift. Let's talk about gender identity. First and foremost, I am not a doctor, nor do I have any medical or therapy-based education, and cannot begin to speak with any authority on the complexities of gender orientation and identity. For the record, I identify as a straight woman, though I find Hayley Atwell or Rachel Weisz as they are lesbian fantasies of mine. Make it that what you will. There are reports on Elagabalus wanting to change their gender via surgery. Dio relates in chapter 16 of Epitome of Book 80 that Elagabalus carried his lewdness to such a point that he asked the physicians to contrive a woman's vagina in his body by means of an incision, promising them large sums for doing so. From this statement alone, as per Cassius Dio, which again we need to take with a huge mountain of salt as he was no fanboy of Elagabalus, it can be interpreted that Elagabalus wanted to transgender themselves so that they could be a woman with Heracles or any other lover that he was favoring at the time. As I have said, I am no gender identity or transgender expert, so I'm not going to speculate on that, but it could be interpreted that way. That being said, I still will say Elagabalus as they, them, or their, just to be neutral. And also, I'd like to say this could be a gender fluid issue or gender fluidity issue versus a concrete definition of transgender or trans identity. That being said, all of this is speculative in my opinion only and not grounded in fact. All that being said, I can definitely tell you, in my opinion, Elagabalus was bisexual. Hardcore bisexual, since he slept with scores of women and slept with men. Continuing with the questionable gender identity issues, Cassius Dio also relates another story of Elagabalus and Aurelius Zodicus, which I mentioned earlier. Once Elagabalus saw Aurelius, Elagabalus had taken a ravishing feminine pose and turning his eyes upon him with a melting gaze, answered without hesitation, "Call me not Lord, for I am a lady." There's speculation that Elagabalus may have identified themselves as a woman. During this episode, I purposely used gender-neutral verbiage as to not assume or presume Elagabalus' gender identity. I found an article from the North Lincolnshire Museum stated that the museum would henceforth identify Elagabalus with the she-her pronouns. In their opening blurb, the North Lincolnshire Museum describes the reign of Elagabalus with extravagance and excesses, with a reputation for promiscuity and being married several times. You know, a quick summation of this episode. That said, in 2023, the North Lincolnshire Museum, after the quote, "Call me not a lord, for I am a lady," decided to update the identifying pronouns from him, he, to her, she. The museum staff member stated that this was the only polite and respectful to be sensitive to identifying pronouns for people of the past. I listened to another podcast, Noble Blood, hosted by Dana Schwartz. Great show, by the way. And the host, too, decided to address the identifying pronouns as she heard during the episode. Unlike the museum or Ms. Schwartz, because of the sources provided have a significant bias against Elagabalus, I wanted to stay neutral. Again, for trying to avoid any misinformation and not wanting to identify someone's identity without their knowledge. So, was Elagabalus transgender? I cannot possibly deny it, nor can I confirm their preferences. But I can say that Elagabalus gives me hardcore bisexual vibes. Again, with the relations both with multiple women, traveling to the notorious brothels, per Cassius Dio, and having the relationships with Heracles and Aurelius Zedekus. From what I have gathered from researching Elagabalus's life, it was certainly not just privileged, fast-paced lifestyle, particularly when it came to Elagabalus's sex life. I was watching a video on Elagabalus, and the link will be provided in the show notes, and the host certainly characterized Elagabalus as a hypersexual person, and I agree. Elagabalus's lifestyle certainly, socially and culturally, clashed with the more conservative senatorial and equestrian classes. The over-imbibing of parties, rose petal parties, y'all, sleeping in, cavorting with numerous lovers in lower classes, sex workers and entertainers, and also promoting other non-standard religious gods, Elagabalus was not the famous or not the favorite of the Roman elite. Well, this situation was rectified in 222 AD as Elagabalus's reign came to an end. Prior to his death, which I will get into shortly, Elagabalus chose his younger cousin as his successor, as Elagabalus had no issue with any of his wives. After all of Elagabalus's antics, his grandmother Julia Maesa and the Praetorian Guards got fed up with Elagabalus's lack of governance, as well as his extravagant parties and lifestyle. Also, Elagabalus became suspicious of their younger cousin and heir, Alexianus, later known as Alexander Severus, and ordered them to be executed. This, however, did not occur. To make it very simple, Elagabalus was persona non grata to the Roman elite and the people. See, I even threw in some Latin for you. On the 11th of March 222 AD, his grandmother, Julia Maesa, and the Praetorian Guard executed Elagabalus, his mother, Julia Soemius. To add further insult to their injuries, the Praetorian Guard also executed Heracles, longtime, well, for the reign at least, lover and favorite of Elagabalus, who was also executed along with other hangers-on and other supporters of Elagabalus. Furthermore, Elagabalus and Julia Soemius, thereby bodies were dragged through the streets of Rome and unceremoniously tossed in the Tiber. Again, remember Cassius Dio gave Elagabalus the post-mortem appellation of Tiberinus. Like, they were tossed in there as what we would call unwanted trash. There's a loving testament. I think this is the theme of Elagabalus's life and his reign. Fuck around and find out. And that's when the Praetorian Guard will come around and give you what's what. I should also add that even though the Praetorian Guard, as I explained just recently, were the ones that killed and executed Julius Soemius and Elagabalus, guess who gave the orders to kill them? That's right, Grandma Julia Maesa. Ooh, like I said, fuck around and find out. Shall we hear what happened to the wives and favorites of Elagabalus after he died? Let's go. So what happened to the wives and lovers of Elagabalus? Sources are limited, but here's what I found. Julia Cornelia Paula divorced in 220, and after their divorce, she was demoted from empress back to a private Roman citizen. There's no conclusive data as to when she died, and her fate is unknown. Aquilia Severa. After divorcing Julia Cornelia Paula to marry her, Elagabalus committed a huge scandal as prying and kidnapping a Vestal virgin before her religious commitment was completed. As we know, it was a sacrilegious crime and a capital one. Nothing happened to Elagabalus when he did that. Must be nice to be the emperor. Subsequently divorced by force via Julia Maesa, she did outlive Elagabalus. Annia Faustina, great-granddaughter of Marcus Aurelius. Their marriage, contracted by Julia Maesa, was considered a much better match as it was a more socially acceptable match in Roman society. Eventually, Elagabalus' divorce put aside Annia to remarry Aquila Severa. After their divorce, she went back to her estates, the Pisidian estates, and to her children. She was outlived by her daughter and her descendants who were involved in Roman social and political circles. There's no record of her life after the death of Elagabalus, and her death date is unknown. Here we go again. Aquilia Severa remarried, potentially against her will. There's some speculation Aquilia may have been with her spouse until their end. Her fate is not known after the execution of Elagabalus. I also forgot to mention the aftermath of what happened to Heracles as well as Aurelius Zodicus. Yeah, they didn't fare well. Actually, I take that back. Heracles, like Elagabalus, did die and was executed by the Praetorian Guard along with Elagabalus' mother and other hangers-on, as I spoke previously. Aurelius Zodicus actually escaped because Heracles, being the nasty little asshole that he is, decided to drug Aurelius' drink, preventing him from getting an erection and able to, or rather unable to, supply Elagabalus with their sexual favors. So Aurelius was then stripped of their honors, you know, any titles or favors given or bequeathed by the Roman emperor, and then kicked out of Italy. So it can be presumed or assumed that Aurelia Zotikus survived the wrath of the imperial family. Every time I say Emisa, I think of Jar Jar Binks going, Misa, Misa, and I absolutely hate that. So now that we know Ella Galbus has been covered, let's discuss whether or not as a lover notorious or not. I mean, the basic answer is fuck yeah.
Notorious lover.
Absolutely a notorious lover with all the shenanigans, the sex scandals, and ooh, yes, that being said, Ella Galbus had multiple lovers, both male and female, as they were married 4 times, twice to the same woman, Aquileia Severa. But this may have been because of the social and religious reasons, which she may never have consented into the relationship in the first place, or relationships. Ella Galbus was certainly entertaining and a notorious lover. Particularly for the Roman imperial history, Ella Galbus's reign was chaotic, sex-fueled, and ended brutally. As to their gender identity is not something I can truly address. I've already made that stance clear, as I am not someone who can confidently use the pronouns for Ella Galbus as they wished. So they are a they. Ella Galbus is an interesting person, as their reign was significantly different compared to Caligula, Nero, or even that of Julius Caesar and Augustus. Ella Galbus's lack of governance, unfortunately, was not found with favor with the Roman elite. Thankfully, you know, Ella Galbus was initially guided by his grandmother and his mother, but then everything just went downhill. It can also be said that Ella Galbus was there for more of a figurehead identity of the Roman Empire versus actually governing, and that it was Grandma, Julia Maesa, running the show. And that happened after he was executed because the cousin, Severus Alexander, became the next victim of Julia Maesa's conniving political intrigues and power. Like most young rulers, hormones took over, which the Roman leaders found much to be desired by a young teenager. Suffice to say, Ella Galbus was an interesting character from the Roman Empire history. Ella Galbus lived a most lascivious life. Essentially fucked his way during their reign. They participated in many sex scandals and put on many shenanigans. Ella Galbus was fun. I hope you enjoyed this episode. A new episode shall soon be coming forth. Thank you for listening to today's episode. As usual, as I try to tell you, try not to get into any shenanigans yourself, as they may end up telling your story. You can reach out to the show via email, sexscandalshenaniganspod@gmail.com. Also, the website, sexscandalshenanigans.my.canva.site, has been deactivated. If you wish to view the episodes, please visit my RSS link for all episodes, although they'll still be uploaded to wherever you listen to your podcast. Thank you again for listening, and until next time, bye!